in the last session of voting, educating, engaging, motivating, and working together as pro-life people. So keep that in mind as we go into our next talk. I'd like to introduce, this is a radio talk show, most people are never thinking about interviewing. The young man is going to introduce our guest speaker for this morning, Jason Sokol. He's the one who's been helping us with our Q&A. And by the way, Brian is not going to be answering questions for the sake of time here in this session. He has a book signing immediately following. He'll be here all day at his booth, and he'll be happy to talk to you individually. Jason is the youth chair and mic runner extraordinaire of the Bringing America Back to Life Symposium. He comes to us from Baldwin Wallace College, where he's studying political science and broadcasting with the goal of becoming a broadcaster. We need to talk. He is also the president of Baldwin Wallace Right to Life, a group that works tirelessly to spread the pro-life message on the campus. And Jason is going to introduce our guest speaker for this morning.
It's great to be here. It's great to see all the young people here and to be able to introduce a great speaker like Brian Kemper. Brian Kemper is the founder and president of Stand True Ministries, a Christ-centered pro-life group determined to awaken the youth of this country and share the message of life and the gospel of Christ. In 1987, Brian started his work in the Christian music industry. He was determined to be a rock star, to stand on a stage and share his testimony between songs, but God had other plans. In 1993, Brian combined his passion for music and pro-life into one organization called Rock for Life. A passionate and compelling orator, he has spoken at high schools and colleges across the country, including Harvard, Princeton, Rutgers, Notre Dame, Ball State, University of Akron, and some school called Baldwin Wallace. He's also spoken to audiences as far away as Ireland and Austria, and was in New Zealand in January of this year. In the past, he was a regular guest on the television show Politically Incorrect with Bill Maher and co-hosted his own call-in cable show in Portland, Oregon. Brian has been featured on MTV, radio shows, newspapers, and magazines, including the cover of the New York Times and a six-page layout in Swing Generation. He's also been featured in three documentary movies. Aside from his speaking, Brian also writes. His articles have appeared in many magazines and pro-life publications. Kemper efforts to engage the youth and encouraging this generation to get involved caused him to start another ministry called Stand True Ministries. Stand True is an organization that believes that the only way to stop abortion is to call out Jesus and share his love with the nation. It's an organization that asks of young people, will you stand? Brian has certainly chosen to, and he can only hope and pray that others will too. Ladies and gentlemen, Brian Kemper.
Now, for everyone who's been wondering who this crazy tattooed guy walking around the conference is, I'm not a pro abort. I'm not on the other side. I've been able to speak at Right to Life conferences all around the world. California, Ireland, New Zealand, Australia, Scotland. I'm going to Scotland in like 10 days for a big Right to Life conference over there. But now that I've gotten to come to Cleveland Right to Life, now I've hit the big time. I'm going to tell you a little bit about myself. How many people were at my talk the other night at the 40 Days for Life?
Yeah.
Good. Not of us. So some of you guys can sleep for the first 10 minutes or so as I get into that part. But I'm going to tell you a little bit about myself. And I don't, are we on video? Because I do move around, just to give you a heads up. I don't like podiums very much. But I'm going to tell you a little bit about myself and why I'm here and why I do what I do, why I travel the world and am willing to live in a van all summer and eat peanut butter and jelly and work with young people and why I do that. And it's because, I have not always been this fine, upstanding citizen that you see before you right now. I actually had a pretty rough childhood and a pretty rough growing up. The first 9 months of my life were extremely negative in the womb. My mother, in California, in 1967, tried to find an abortion. She tried to have me aborted. She was not successful, obviously. When my grandparents found out that my mother was pregnant, their first reaction was pure shame. They were so ashamed of my mother and of me that they made my mother move to another city to live in a home so none of the neighbors or anyone they know would find out that my mother was pregnant. So that was the first 9 months of my life that negativity talked into my life. When I was born, I then had a disease called spinal meningitis. And I was in a hospital as an infant for a long time. They used to have to keep me in barrels of ice to keep my temperature down. At one point, I was pronounced clinically dead. The doctor went to tell my mother I was dead. Another doctor revived me and said, no, he's alive, he's alive. But he's probably going to be a vegetable or severely mentally retarded for the rest of his life. That's what they told my parents. So my mom was not married at the time. She ended up marrying my father right after that, divorced him almost immediately, married another man, divorced him when I was younger, and then he married someone, she married someone, my dad married someone, just this whole spider web. And I was passed around from parent to parent to parent. I was beaten, I was abused, I was molested as a child. I lived in a family that absolutely had no love for God whatsoever. There was no hope. There was no God. My parents really just didn't care much about me at all. In the sixth grade, I won 3 blue ribbons in the Special Olympics. I used to ride a little short yellow bus to school. I was considered partially mentally retarded. And then at age 12, I had been passed around so much that most of my parents, my mom didn't want me, my adoptive father didn't want me anymore. So they introduced me to my real father out in Los Angeles, California, who I had never met before, and they shipped me off to live with my real father. And when I got there, they put me into a regular junior high school, but I was in half special education, half regular classes. So in this junior high school in L.A., I would go into special ed in the morning, then they send me to a regular class, and you can imagine the teasing and how picked on I was, because I was a special ed kid. It got so bad that they used to have to let me out of school 5 minutes before anyone else because of how much I got beaten up. I was a little skinny kid on Ritalin, and I got beat up so bad that literally they let me out of school before other people. So at that point in my life, my dad had a lot of drugs in the house, and so basically I spent most of my time just getting high, getting wasted. That was my life. I had to escape from this somehow, so I just basically spent my whole time getting high. By the time I was 16, I had ran away from home once for 2 weeks, and my parents actually never knew I was gone from the house. That's the kind of house I lived in. So at age 17, I was living on the streets of Los Angeles. I lived under the Hermosa Beach Pier, and I would prostitute myself for food and shelter at times. And I ended up meeting an Army recruiter by chance, and started talking to this Army recruiter, and she's like, we can help you get your life straight. We'll get you to join the Army. So she got me off the streets, I joined the Army, and I was kicked out of the Army within less than 6 months. They caught me trying to hang myself in the barracks. So at age 20, I'm back in Los Angeles, California. I'm living part-time with my girlfriend, and the rest of the time I was living with my drug supplier. My job was, I was the nanny for their baby. So they would give me drugs in trade for being a nanny for their baby. And they knew that I was using the drugs while taking care of their child. I had absolutely no respect for my fellow human person whatsoever. No respect for my fellow human person. So, 1987, 20 years old, living in L.A., and I get up one morning to go to a concert. I was going to go to the Grateful Dead Bob Dylan at Anaheim Stadium. If you watch baseball, it's where the Angels play baseball. So I started the morning. I took 2 or 3 lines of crystal meth, snorted some crystal meth. Now, as I tell you the story, understand, I should not be alive today for the amount of drugs that I ingested in my body that day. I should not be alive, let alone have any memory of that day whatsoever. But God has given me a crystal clear memory of that day. I started the line on several lines of crystal meth. I smoked some pot. I got dropped off at Anaheim Stadium. I got in line. I took a handful of jelly beans that were dipped in LSD and ate the whole handful. I got up to the front. I drank a bunch of orange juice, which I later found out was full of methadone, which is similar to heroin. Inside the concert, I took a hit off a PCP stick. I ate a whole handful of hallucinogenic mushrooms, and I smoked pot throughout the whole day, and at the end of the night as I was leaving the concert, I took 2 more hits of LSD and popped those in. My next memory was standing in a phone booth screaming to the operator to get the phone out of my head. I believe the phone had actually melted into my head. And as I'm doing that, the ambulance and the fire trucks came up. And the fireman put me into the ambulance, and I laid my head back. Everything went ghost white, and I said, am I dead? And the fireman looks down and goes, no, you're on drugs. But the worst part is he looked just like the guy from the Planet of the Apes. was this ape man going, "You're on drugs." That was my reality. They rushed me to UC Irvine Medical Center. And I'm in a wheelchair that's locked to the wall. One arm, my right arm is strapped to the wheelchair. My left arm is free, eating these blueberries that were floating in the air. I really thought they were there. I'm just eating these blueberries. And this doctor walks up to me and goes, "You, I need to talk to you." I'm like, "Whatever, dude, give me a cigarette and I'll talk to you." So he goes off to find a cigarette. Now, I don't know how he looked me straight in the face. I mean, I had no shoes on. I'm filthy. My shirt's ripped. I smelled like a dumpster. I've got a mohawk, a safety pin stuck through my nose. My mouth is completely black from all the charcoal water the nurses have been pouring down my throat to soak the poison and the drugs out of my body. And he comes back and he unlocks my wheelchair and I realize what was about to happen. I was about to get preached at. I hated Christians with a passion. All my life, all I'd ever been told is, "You're evil, you're going to hell, you listen to Ozzy Osbourne, you're the devil." That was my perception of Christianity. So I hated Christians, but he had a cigarette for me, so I figured I'd go to church, you know. He takes me outside, he gives me the cigarette, the matches, and he sits down, and I'm waiting for him to start telling me how evil I am, how horrible I am. And he comes up and he looks at me and he goes, "You know, God loves you so much. You are so valuable to God. And you are worth way more than this. There's hope for you with Jesus." No one in my life had ever told me I had value. No one had ever told me there was hope for me. All my life I've been told it was hopeless. And this man just told me I had value and that God loved me. I thought God hated me. I thought I was one of the worst in the world, that God could not stand me. So I went home the next day and I told my girlfriend, I said, "I got to go swimming out in the ocean. I got to clear my head." And so we go out in the ocean in Long Beach, California, and a boat comes up beside me. I'm in the harbor right as it goes into the ocean. And a guy in the boat looks down and says, "You were at the Grateful Dead Bob Dylan concert." Now understand, this is the next day, an hour away in another city in the Pacific Ocean. It was the fireman that put me in the ambulance. And he looks down and he says, "You know, God loves you so much. You are so valuable to God." He said almost word for word what that doctor had said to me. And I freaked out. This is like a movie script, okay? This is not real life. And I went home and I slept for a couple of days and I woke up and I started bawling my eyes out. I started to get high. I was rolling a joint. We call them a cocoa puff. You put cocaine or crystal meth inside of the joint. And I was rolling that and started to smoke it and I started to bawl my eyes out. Now, I had no idea why I was crying. I'm a tough punk rocker, okay? I was tough. I go into slam pits for 4 hours a night. If you don't know what a slam pit is, it's when you go to a concert, everybody just runs and slams into each other all night. Okay? That's what I would do all night. I had a big safety pin. I just shoved through my nose. I didn't cry for anything. Yet I'm bawling my... Now, my wife will tell you now, though, 5 minutes of extreme home makeover and I'm lost it. But back then, I did not cry. And I start bawling and I reach in my pocket and there's a phone number and I call the phone number. The doctor had given me this paper and I said, "I'm on drugs and I'm going to die. Can you help me?" And it was a pastor of a church. He said, "Come to our church." So I showed up. He said, "We're going to give you a place to live. We're going to give you clothing. We're going to give you food. We're going to give you shelter. We're going to give you a job. We're going to help you get clean. The only thing that we ask is, will you give God a chance?" Okay. Tried everything else. We'll see what God can do. So I get there, and the next morning, they wake me up at like 5 in the morning before God's even awake. I'm just like, "Oh, gosh." And the worst part is they're so happy. They're just like, "Good morning, brother. Hallelujah." And hugging and like all these yucky, happy Jesus freaks. Oh, gross. Disgusting. So I spent the next 3 days hiding in the back corner of the thrift store they had me working at, sneaking out the back for cigarettes as much as I can. And I just hated these people. Just, oh, they were so happy and nice. You know, like, nobody's that nice, are they? Really? Like, where is this joy coming from? And the third night, I started to shake. My whole body started to shake. I started to pour out sweat. And I laid down in the bed and I started to hallucinate the shadows of the trees trying to eat me. And my body started going through these withdrawals. And they came in and they prayed over me. And all of a sudden, the shake stopped. The sweat stopped. I felt like a cloud of something just poured out of my head. I felt like 50,000 pounds lifted off my chest. And I fell into the most beautiful sleep I had ever had in my life. The most restful night of sleep I had ever had. And the only way I can actually describe what happens next is I basically woke up a happy Jesus freak. I was like, tell me about Jesus! Why do I feel this way? What is causing this? Why do I feel so good? And I sat down and I opened up, they said, read John. And I read the Gospel of John from front to back. And I fell in love with our Savior, Jesus Christ, that day in 1987. And I have not been back to drugs ever since that day. Now listen, I tell that story for two reasons. Two reasons. The first reason is I should not be standing here today. I should not be standing here. What I have accomplished in my life, going from the scumbag, drug dealer, criminal, I've committed crimes that would make you probably run out of this room and hide from me, that I should be in prison for. The stuff that I've done to people. And now, I'm traveling. I just got back from New Zealand on a two-week tour with Jill Stanek speaking. I leave in 7 days for Scotland, and then I'm in Belgium for a week. I traveled all over the world. I've been to Europe 4 times in the last year speaking. I've been in 3 documentary movies. I've sang on major Christian albums. I've been given the most beautiful, amazing bride on the face of the earth. And 6 beautiful children and 2 children that are with God. None of that is possible but by the blood of Jesus. None of that. So, for me to even stand up here, I must at all times first give glory to Jesus Christ and give Him the honor, because it's not my words here. It's Him. It's not my power. It's nothing that I've accomplished in my life is without Jesus. So that's the first reason I always tell that story. But the second reason is because I had no respect for my fellow human person whatsoever. No respect at all. And that's really what the abortion issue is about. It's not about the procedure of abortion. It's about the personhood of the child inside the womb. It's about the fact that every single child inside the womb, every single child created from the moment of fertilization to natural death, is an equal human person with equal value. That's what this issue is about, and that's what we're fighting for. And there have been many times in our history, when personhood has been stripped away from groups of people. Now, there's a lot of young people in here. You guys are going to read, if you haven't yet, you're going to probably study about a man named Dred Scott. Dred Scott and his wife lived at a time when, because he was black, he was only considered 3/5 of a human person. Only 3/5 of a human being. So he sued the United States government to be declared a full human person. And our Supreme Court of the United States of America, our Supreme Court, declared no. No, you're not a full human person. And they upheld that 3/5 of a human. Now, I used to live in a town called Fredericksburg, Virginia. Anybody been to Fredericksburg, Virginia? Oh, awesome. Never had that many people raise their hand. Fredericksburg considers themselves to be the most historical city in the country. That's what they call themselves. They have the house that George Washington built for their mother. See, back then, kids actually did things for their parents. Okay? So you got the house that George Washington built for his mother. And in Fredericksburg, you have the tavern called the Rising Sun Tavern. This is the tavern that George Washington's brother owned, and they claim that that's where they first talked about the Declaration of Independence. But to me, the most historical thing in Fredericksburg is not even on most of the tours. It's not even something that people point out. But I think it's the most important thing in that whole city is a piece of stone cemented into a sidewalk corner. This stone was sort of the mall of that time. You could go to that stone on a Saturday morning and they'd sell you a barrel of corn. Or they'd sell you a horse. But more importantly, they would take a human person and they would walk them up and they would stand them on that stone. And simply because of the color of their skin, they would sell this human person like a piece of property. This was a slave trading block. And this block is not in that sidewalk today to glorify what happened in our history. It is there to tell us, as a society, we cannot go back. We cannot return to a time when our brothers and sisters are treated like a piece of property. We cannot allow that to happen again. And that's why that stone is there. You all know what happened in Nazi Germany? You know what Adolf Hitler and the Nazi Party did? We've seen the videos. We've been to the museums. Read the books. It wasn't enough for me. I wanted to really understand how a society, how a world can get to a point like that. So a couple of years ago when I was invited to speak in Europe, my best friend Jeremy, my wife doesn't like to travel, so my best friend goes as my accountability partner most of the time. So my wife won't go overseas. So him and I decided, you know what? We're over here, we can take a little cheap Ryanair flight to Krakow, Poland. So we'd flow to Krakow, Poland. And the next morning we got up and we got on a bus from Krakow to Auschwitz. And you know, it was strange because in the morning we went to a store before we got to the bus and I got a bag of Doritos or something equivalent in Polish. And I got a couple of cold Pepsi Max. They don't really sell Diet Pepsi there, they sell Pepsi Max. Couple of cold Pepsi Maxes and a bag of Doritos. Jeremy got, I think, some Starbucks drinks. They have Starbucks everywhere. And we got on that bus and we started complaining because it's Europe and they don't shower. So we're on that bus and it kind of smells, you know. And the driver's chain smoking, like, now on the bus as we're going. And as we're driving there and I'm complaining, there's no bathroom on the bus. And I'm just like, oh, gosh. And I look out my window and I see these train tracks going the same way that I'm going. And I started to think, I wonder if these are the tracks that lead to Auschwitz. And I started to think about the conditions they have on that train. I'm on an air-conditioned bus with a bag of Doritos and an ice-cold soda. And I'm complaining as I'm going to Auschwitz? And that set the mood for the day. And we got to Auschwitz and we got off. And you walk in and there's that iron, that wrought iron arch that says in German, work makes free. Mm-hmm. You see, they would lie to the Jews and play mind games with them and tell them, we're gonna give you a new house and a new life. And if you work really hard, you're going to get your freedom back. So as they walked into Auschwitz, they saw that. Now, probably one of the most life-changing, if you haven't been somewhere like that, you got to go. It's one of the most life-changing things. Auschwitz will affect everybody in different ways. And in that first camp, you go to two camps there. You go to Auschwitz and you go to Birkenau. And there's so many things that can affect you. For me, it was one building that affected me more than any other. And this building housed three different displays. The first display was a giant pile of hair. And as you're looking at the hair, the tour guide says, look behind you. And there's a jacket and a blanket right here. And as you look really close to that jacket and that blanket, you realize it's woven out of human hair. They would take the hair from the Jews and make black blankets and jackets to keep the Nazis warm. And then you walk into this next room, and it's a giant pile of prosthetic legs and arms. And I'm looking at them thinking, these are pieces of people. Pieces of human beings. But nothing can prepare me for what I saw next. As I walked into that next room, I saw a glass table. And inside that glass table were baby clothes. And in that glass table of baby clothes was a little pair of hand-knit wool shorts. I thought back to my house. Because at that time, my youngest child was Atticus. Little Atticus at night. Atticus wears cloth diapers. All my children wear cloth diapers. And at nighttime, when you use cloth diapers, you put on over the cloth diapers a little hand-knit pair of wool shorts. And I'm looking at these and they look just like the ones that I put on Atticus every night. And I'm thinking about my little boy, thinking about how there's this child that was wearing these little hand-knit wool shorts and they were taken off of this child just like Atticus, but this child ended up in an incinerator. And I walked out of that building just, I couldn't speak. I didn't know what to think. And we got onto a bus and we went to Birkenau. And as we walked in, we noticed there's those train tracks leading right into the big, right into the front. The first thing they did is they take us to a barracks on the right. And there's this long line, about as long as this row of chairs, of cement with holes in it. This was the toilet. No curtains, no dividers, no modesty, no separation whatsoever. Now, the most sought-after job of the Jews, the job that they wanted the most, that they tried to get the most in this camp, was the person that would crawl into these toilets with their bare hands and clean them out. Because you were only allowed to use the bathroom twice a day there. And so the person that did that got to work indoors and got to use the bathroom whenever they wanted. Can you imagine a life where the job that you go to college for and that you study for and you strive for is to crawl into a toilet with your bare hands and clean out human excrement? That was their life. Then they walked us down the tracks and we got to this rock platform. And this is where they would unload the Jews from the train. And they would come out of that train and they'd been standing like this for 8 days, for 9 days, holding every possession they had. There was no sitting down in those 8 or 9 days. There was no laying down in those 8 or 9 days. There was no bathroom. You went in your pants. And if you wanted to eat or drink, you had to have had food or water in your possessions. So you have people with no food or water that whole time. So you have dead bodies leaning against you. And they finally unload you off that train. And the German soldiers would come in and they would look at you guys right here in this group and say, you guys look pretty healthy right here. Okay? So we're going to send you off to those barracks and you're going to get a good job. Okay? So they take you right here, this little group right here, and they'd send you off to the barracks for your job. But they'd come over here and say, you guys look kind of tired. You're a little bit older. You know? You know what we're going to do? We're going to get you a nice hot shower and some fresh clothes. That's what they would tell you over here. And so what they do is they send them off to their job and then they take you guys over here. And they march you down those tracks, and we're walking down those tracks. And they take you into this building that's there. It's just rubble right now. But we had seen a model earlier in the day of what that building looked like. And they would take you in there, and they would have you take your clothes off. And they would tell you to put them on a number so you could remember, so you can get your fresh, clean clothes. And then they would walk you naked. It doesn't matter. There's boys, girls, grandmas, grandpas, everybody together. There's no modesty. You're completely naked, but all you care about is after 9 days of that, I'm going to get a hot shower. And they'd walk you into that shower room and you'd be happy and you'd look up and wait for that water to come down. And then that ceiling hole would open and you'd be like, what is that? And then that can would drop to the floor. And then that gas would start to pour out. And 20 minutes later, every one of you is dead. They would play that mind game with you all the way to that last moment of your life. And you're all dead. But see, then they would come back to you guys right here. Remember, you guys got a job to do. And they would take you around the back of that building. And you would walk in there. And right over there is your grandmother lying on the floor dead. And they would tell you to pick up her body and put it in an incinerator. And if you didn't do it, they would shoot you in the head on the spot. And right over there is your mother laying on the floor, gassed to death. And if you even hesitate from picking up her body, they would shoot you. And I'm standing there looking at this going, how did this happen? How did this happen just 70 years ago in the time of my grandparents? How did our world let something so horrific so disgusting, so satanic happen? How? And I look past the buildings, and there's an old house. And I looked at that house and I thought to myself, wait a minute. What if I lived in Poland during that time? What if I lived in that house? What if one Saturday morning in the 1940s, what if I got up on a Saturday morning and I got my cup of coffee and I walked out in my backyard and my kids are playing soccer in the backyard and I looked out and I saw this camp, this death camp. And I saw them taking the Jews into that building. And I saw that smokestack light up. And I saw that human ash pour into the air. What would I have done? If one of them escaped, would I have hid them in my basement? Would I have been willing to go and cut a hole in the fence so they can get out of there? Or would I have taken my kids, hurried them in the house, closed the curtains, and said, that's too bad. And I was asking myself that, and God spoke to me and said, Brian, don't you understand, Brian? That is your house. That is your house. That's your house. It's your house. It's your house. That house belongs to all of us because today, in our own backyards, there are buildings where innocent, precious children are taken in every day by the thousands. And they're not going up in smokestacks, but they're coming out in trash cans and medical waste containers. Every one of us lives in that house, and we don't have to ask ourselves, what would I have done? What we have to ask ourselves is, what am I doing now? What am I doing now when they are slaughtering innocent human beings in my backyard? We all live there. Every day in our nation, almost 4,000 innocent baby boys and girls are killed by surgical abortion. But it's obvious that not even the Christians completely believe that. Otherwise, we'd be in the Cleveland Stadium today, not in this little room. And some people go, well, Brian, come on. There's a little bit of a difference between the Jews that are being killed in the concentration camp and the children that are dying in the abortion clinics. There's a difference. Well, no, there is. There's actually two differences. Two differences. The first difference is their age. They're simply in a different stage of the life of a human being. Zygote, embryo, fetus, infant, toddler, teenager, adult, senior citizen, all of those are stages of the life of a human being, not potential life. A zygote is not going to suddenly become an orangutan. It's a human being. So the first difference is just their age. But the second difference is the reason that we're here today. The second difference is why I am here today. It's why Father Pavone flew out here today. It's why Star Parker came here today. It's why Cleveland Rights of Life put on this conference. It's all about you, that second difference. Do you guys, most of you, remember Hurricane Katrina? Do you remember when the news helicopters started flying over New Orleans and those people are wading through the river holding their children going, help me! Help! And they're standing next to that Super Bowl, that Superdome, and they're crying out for help. Do you guys remember that?
Yeah.
That's the difference. The babies that are being killed do not have a voice. They cannot cry out for help. They need a voice. They need us. They need the church of Jesus Christ to stand up and say, I will be a voice for you. I will cry out for you. Some of you may say, well, Brian, it's obviously that's what you're called to do. You're called to do that. I'm not called to that. That's not my calling in life. I know for a fact that God tells us that we are to love our neighbor as ourselves. We are called to love our neighbor as ourselves.
Amen.
Is our neighbor the guy that lives next door that won't return your hammer? Is that the only neighbor we have? No. Our neighbor, is that my red card?
You have 5 minutes.
All right. We'll take 10. Our neighbor is our fellow human person. And God gave us such a beautiful example of what loving our neighbor and what being called to do. And so I'm going to need a volunteer. Colton? Excuse me, I know your name. Colton, I need you to pretend it's Cornerstone Festival and line that muddy ditch. Okay? So Colton's in this ditch, right? Somebody beat him up and robbed him. Okay? You know where I'm going here, don't you? Okay? I hope so, otherwise you haven't been to enough Sunday school. Anyway. So there's Colton. He's been robbed. He's lying in that ditch. Right? Priest is coming by. And I'm called to something else. The priest goes this way. Then the Levite comes by. But he's called to something else. So he goes this way. Here comes the Good Samaritan. The father of the bone, correct me if I'm wrong. You know the Bible better than I do, brother. Correct me if I'm wrong, Father. Is there any version from any denomination or anywhere that says that the Good Samaritan first stopped, got on his knees and said, God, am I called to a ditch ministry? Good Samaritan. He saw his brother lying in the ditch. He reached down and he loved his neighbor as himself then. I know I only have like 2 minutes left, so, and I got like 20 minutes worth of stuff to say. Let me ask you this. Simple question. Do you really, really believe that every human being inside the womb is a fully human person? Do you really believe that? Because I thought my church did. February 23rd, 14, 15 days ago, laying in bed, I heard my wife scream. As I went into the bathroom, my 12-week-old preborn son was in the toilet. I picked my son out of that toilet, and we rushed my wife to the emergency room because she was bleeding to death. She lost over 2 pints of blood, almost passed out. The doctors were able to help her. She stayed a couple days in the hospital. She's better now. She's at home resting. Of course, what we did is we called the funeral home. We got a gravesite. We bought a coffin. And we held a funeral for my son. 2 families from my church showed up. 2. My pastor and one other family. I know for a fact that that would have been any one of my other 6 children that are walking around the church every day, every Sunday. The whole church would have been there. Everybody would have been there. But for some reason, they just can't completely understand that Benjamin Davis, though he was only 12 weeks in the womb, is just as valuable as my little girl Abigail that's sitting at the table out there selling my t-shirts right now. And until the church can understand that, until the church can start acting like we believe it, how is the world going to believe it?
Amen.
And I'll be there for questions afterwards because we don't have time and I have a table there. I'd love you to come by and stuff. But my question for you is when you leave this room today, okay? There's a ditch right there at that door, okay? There's a ditch. Colton's not laying in the ditch anymore. Inside that ditch right now are almost 4,000 precious baby boys and girls. So when you walk out that door and pass that ditch, you have to ask yourself, are you going to be the priest? Are you going to be the Levite? Or today, are you willing to commit to being the Samaritan? Thank you so much.
you to support all of our booths out there, especially Stand True. And the Cleveland Right to Life booth, you can order a CD of what you heard. We sell those out there. Also, we'd love you to check us out on Facebook, facebook.com/ClevelandRTL. Get updates, action notices, all kinds of fun stuff like that. We're going to take a few minutes break, and then we'll be having lunch next door with Star Park. Thank you.
My interest is incredible on the action. I have with the pledge cards for the 4 days, and they are also for
Invisible.